You know, when the organizer, or actually the main organizer, Nicola, just suggested me to make this kind of concluding remarks, when I agreed, I thought that I will better, instead of say, simply waiting till the end of the conference and summarizing what the other people already said, I just decided that I will prepare something in advance, something like some thoughts. And that's it, you see it here. And it's a fake PowerPoint, or maybe to put it more politely, poor man's PowerPoint. And you see here. So that's essentially what I wanted to just to say, just a few ideas, a few words, and a few problems. And mostly trying to kind of concentrate on what, at least in my opinion, are open problems. Of course, it's a very personal point of view, and you are perfectly free to agree or disagree with me, and I'm perfectly happy with that. Now, when we just spoke about this program of conference, we just thought of several highlights. And that, as you will see, that I prepared actually these slides maybe 2.5 weeks in advance, but I am not very, very far away from what really happened at the conference. So I'm kind of glad that it's the case. We thought of several highlights, like orbitals, multiferroic frustration, and then interfaces in multilayers. And that's more or less what we had, maybe a little bit less of orbitals. And then I also want maybe just to go quickly through these points, but also to just mention some other points which, in my opinion, are very important, and maybe somewhat less treated in this context. Okay, just orbital physics, very quickly. In principle, it's not a new field, and it was very popular in the 60s, 70s, under a different name, actually. People didn't speak about orbital learning, but mostly spoke about cooperative Antlr effects at that time. Then it's kind of died out, and it's resurfaced and reappeared after HITC, and especially after colossal magnetic resistance manganite, as you all know. That's actually pretty well-known story, but there is certain very interesting recent development, in particular this reduced dimensionality due to orbital loading and orbital frustration, and especially quantum effects, which I come to closer to the end. So reduced dimensionality, that's actually old picture, this EG electrons with cubic, practically cubic perovskite material, potassium copper fluoride. But due to this orbital loading, which is shown here, we have very strong exchange along C direction and very weak ferrocoupling here. It's cubic system, but one of the best one-dimensional magnets. Another example, which may be more closely related to what was discussed in some of the talk here, is frustrated systems and spinels, or maybe this triangular system like lithium-vanadate. That's what picture was from what we did already quite a while ago in Groningen yet. And here we have T2G orbitals, and in these systems, they have three types of them. One of them is green, and we can see that green is, has a lobe only along XY direction. Now, XZ orbital has only lobe in this direction, and red orbitals only along YZ direction. And that actually effectively makes such system almost quasi one-dimensional electronically very often. That helps a lot. Now, next comes question, okay, maybe just go slightly back. That's actually more or less what we understand. Now, what are really interesting and open fundamental problems? I kind of always try to understand this. And for me, actually, well, that's a lot of interesting physics here, but for me, probably the most interesting and open question is actually quantum effects, whether there are strong quantum effects connected with orbitals. And the usual picture is that we describe spins as spin operators, but orbitals also by pseudo-spin operators. And if we have spin waves, if we have quantum spin effect, why not having same quantum effects in orbitals or same orbital excitation, orbitons? And there was some discussion of that and some experiments on that. And actually, largely, that comes to Stuttgart team, to Kaimer experimentally, and Ginyat Khalioulin, especially theoretically. It's still quite an open question, especially because orbitals are very strongly coupled to the lattice. And because of that, very often we treat lattice classically, and that may strongly suppress quantum effects. But one point which I want also to make is that in this Jahn-Teller system, there is one very general phenomena which is known under the name of Weibronic effects, especially if you treat with, single Jantelier impurity. That's actually a very big community dealing with Jantelier effect in molecules or Jantelier effect in impurities. Then they always say that, okay, most important effects are connected with the fact that we have not adiabatic approximation, when we have different electronic states with the same latent distortion state. But for each electronic state, we have its own lattice or nuclear part. And that gives rise to famous kind of effects like, in this field, it's called hem reduction factor, but it's the same as polyharmonic narrowing for non-diagonal matrix elements. And especially for EG electrons, for instance, in concentrated systems or isolated atom, actually has the whole true of minima. So we give rise actually that for isolated Jantelier effect, we have rotational quantization, we have all these phenomena connected with Berry phase and so on. And interesting point is that people working with isolated Jantelier impurity, they mostly work about this, with these problems. But when we are dealing with concentrated systems, we practically always forget it. Always treat lattice classically. And the question is, well, maybe that's really a real situation. Maybe we are allowed to forget it, but maybe there could be some quantum effects connected also with this. Not just quantum orbitals, but also quantum orbitals plus quantum treatment of lattice. It's an open question, I don't really know. Okay, now I go to the next point, which would be multi-ferroic, and actually that's a somewhat interesting sociological problem, I would say. Well, you all know that actually the sessions in physics actually, at least in condensed matter, changes with time. So 80s it was for mostly say, mixed valence heavy fermions, then after high TC period, of course it kills everything. And it was mostly everyone was doing high TC. And then later on, it was colossal magnetic resistance manganates. Now it seems that multi-ferroic kind of takes over. And the good way to have some feeling of what's really fashionable is just to look at the program of March meetings of American Physical Society. And in 95, it was kind of high TC sessions, high TC 1, high TC 2, high TC 14, high TC 25, and so on. Later on, it was kind of CMR, CMR 1, 7, 17, up to 17. So I just, well, I, a bit lazy, but not completely lazy. I just looked at March meetings. And that's actually the graph of tendency. It's normalized, actually. Be careful. That's actually normalized to the maximum for this year. And I was lazy. I didn't go below 97. So that's high TC, blue one. That was maximum, at least in this age, was somewhere here. But probably if I go just before 87, it was probably even much higher. Then it went down. Somehow there is some upsurge of interest to 2007. I don't know why is that. Maybe that's simply because there were more talks at all. bigger meeting, maybe. Now you see that then colossal magnetic resistance reappeared, resurfaced. It started maybe somewhere at around these years. Was also a big one and then went down. And now you see that actually at least from not from absolute scale, I will show you absolute scale in a minute, but now multi-ferroic seems to be gaining somewhat. Actually, I must say that all this new fashion multi-ferroic, it may be traced back, and this particular place, Santa Barbara, and this institute played probably a rather important role in this meeting, because probably Nicolas and maybe some other people remember, in 99 we had this similar program here on spin systems. And we had kind of brainstorming discussion about multiferroic, about why it is zero and so on. And I have a feeling that actually all this new fashion of multiferroic maybe started partially from this meeting. Maybe I'm wrong, but at least that's my feeling. Okay, I promised to show you absolute scale. And of course, in this normalized scale, of course, it looks like, say, superconductivity and colossal magnetic resistance are on the same scale. Of course, we still have much more superconducting talks, definitely, or superconducting sessions. That's actually absolute scale. Maximum is 36, but it may be not completely fair because I also included in high TC also rather big field of vortices. It's about one third of it. But still, but you see that actually in, even in absolute scale, there were maximum of 17 sessions, not talks, but sessions in March meeting in 99, CMR. And now that's reduced maybe I thought to two to three if I remember. And we had last time seven multiferroic sessions.
When
multi-heroic, well, I suppose that the word was invented by Hans Schmidt, or maybe Aizu in Japan also was instrumental. Actually, this comes in my next slide. That's actually, this multi-heroic, it's not really a new business. And people worked on that already in the 70s and 60s and 70s, and largely actually in the USSR, not former USSR, but real USSR at that time. And I remember actually that when I once just told George about this story in 95, and he was kind of interested. Oh, that sounds interesting. Why don't we know anything about that? Remember, George, your reaction. But then it was kind of died out. But at that time already, people realized that there is a possibility to have this common ferroelectric, ferromagnetic, ferroelastic. And I think Hans Schmidt, he's still active in Geneva. He's an old guy, but he's quite a nice guy. He, I think, suggested the word multiferroid. Okay, now, new life actually started really from discovery of this second class of multiferroid. As I said, actually, there are, in principle, two types. Multiferroid in which you have independently, in quotation marks, of course, magnetic and ferroelectric subsystems, different mechanism, different transition temperature. Of course, they are coupled later on. It would be good to find a good coupling. And a recent upsurge of interest came from discovery of mostly by Kimura and Takura of this material and by Sang-Woo Chung of this material of magnetically driven ferroelectricity. In this case, usually polarization is weaker, but the coupling is much stronger. Now, that's actually raise certain questions, theoretical questions, but I would say that maybe the main principal question may be answered. I maybe disappoint someone, and I myself may be a bit disappointed. It's actually fun to work in multiferroic. We are also working in Köln a lot on multiferroic. But frankly speaking, my own opinion is that as to the deep theoretical question, maybe there are not so many. I'm sorry. Actually, of course, it was important after the discovery of this magnetically driven ferroelectricity to understand what it is due to. But after this microscopic or maybe phenomenological works of Katsura, Nagaosa, and Nastavoy, or after this very careful study using this symmetry constraints and symmetry rules, that's what we heard from Amnon Aharoni and Brooks Harris, actually very instrumental that. After this is understood, I don't really know whether there are very many, very deep theoretical problems in multiferroids. So I don't know actually this session, for how long is this session. If it will be successful in practical application, maybe that will be indeed very good. But again, that may be my own feeling only, you may disagree with that. My feeling is that from practical point of view, probably composite multiferroic might be probably the best. Like multi-layers of good ferromagnet and good ferroelectric, or something like that. But of course, it's much more fun to work on this kind of material, which are bulk. And there are a lot of very funny new systems. And it's kind of interesting. So actually, when I thought about these fundamental problems in multiferroic, I thought that, OK, maybe this physics of toroidal moments, maybe something really new and really deep. And maybe there is still something quite interesting in it. But on the other hand, what we also heard, what was clear from Manfred Fibich's talk, there is no one-to-one correspondence between this multiferroic business in general and toroidal moment. And here is actually this simple example. Let's say, suppose I consider this circle and I make these spins like they're rotating, these blue guys. And if you use this already well-known rule, what determines polarization, we see that there exists polarization which sticks out like this shown by red guys. And again, if I look at the definition of toroidal moment, then it's non-zero, and it's shown here by this red. It is non-zero here. So you have both spontaneous polarization, not really total, but at least locally, and you have toroidal moment. But if I consider the same kind of hedgehog like this, when spins are pointing away along the radius, again, if I use the same rule, I have the same polarization, but not toroidal moment. So there is no one-to-one correspondence. At least that's actually a very simple example which shows that there's no one-to-one correspondence. And I don't really know, maybe it would be really interesting to think of some materials in which toroidal moments are really the basic basic order parameter, driving order parameter. But I don't know whether it's really possible. Exactly. That's what I wanted to. I can.
You don't have diagonal components.
There is actually a magnetoelectric tensor, and in one case, diagonal, that's actually a second case, and non diagonal, that's actually a toroidal moment. That's exactly the same. Yeah, that's correct. That's actually the same as division of magnetic field in toroidal and poloidal components. That's actually all goes back to classical electrodynamics of this type. Now, frustrations. Frustrations, it's also a very active field now, and kind of a lot of interest, and at least, well, I'm not such a good expert in frustrations, but it looks like it's really maybe deeper theoretical problems, because there are still possibility of having completely new quantum states, like, say, quantum liquid states, and or spin liquid states, and maybe some more complicated states, so that's kind of very interesting. In particular, actually, we recently played with the notion of Carroll field chirality. That's what we heard also from Claire Louvier, that it may be, there may be some models and some phases in which S average is zero, but this S cube is non-zero. So, say, this scalar chirality is non-zero. That's actually effectively this solid angle made by three spins. Now, that's actually maybe just to illustrate you that Kagome lattice, which is always referred to Japan, was actually known by many people before. That's actually a photograph which I made in Bukhara, in Uzbekistan. That's actually the window in one medesa. It's very nice Kagome lattice. And those of you who have been recently at the workshop in Trieste, they maybe have seen a similar picture. That's actually the floor of the cathedral in Trieste. It's very nice, Kagome lattice. Fine. Then just I cannot resist. Maybe just to use the opportunity to tell at least a word about what we did very recently, and mostly that's actually with Lev Bolayevsky, and that's actually also related both to frustrated system and to multiferroic, but also related to the last part. What I wanted to say, some basic things of Hubbard model. When we are speaking about Hubbard model, what is usual notion? That if we are dealing with, say, one electron per site and very large, strong interaction, then people usually think that, okay, all charge degrees of freedom completely frozen out, only spin degree of freedom remain in the ground state and low energy state. And that actually turns out to be not true. That's actually what we recently did, and the main player is actually Lev Bolayevsky, who will come to this workshop later on. What we obtained, actually, that there exists a real electric effect and strong mod insulator. They are, of course, not very strong, it's only T cube. But it's interesting that there appear spontaneous currents, which are actually proportional to the same spin chirality. So if I have this magnetic structure, then it means that there runs a real electric current, orbital current, like this, and real orbital moment pointing perpendicular to the triangle. That's one thing, and another is also interesting related to multiferroic, is that there may exist also for other spin structures, there may exist a real spin redistribution, so really charge redistribution. So average n is not 1, but it's 1 plus minus something. In which case, for instance, if I have spins shown here by red, then there will appear some charge redistribution which will give you dipole moment in this direction. So it's kind of purely electronic mechanism of multiferroic behavior, could be. This does not require any spin orbit coupling. It works for collinear spins, does not require any shift of the lattice, purely electronic. Of course, it adds to the lattice effect, and it may be numerically very weak, but still it's there. Now, interface multilayers, that seems to be an extremely rich field for engineering, actually. But people mostly kind of spoke, or very often spoke about this interface between band insulator and mod insulator. But from what I saw in the literature right now, main effect which we just saw right now, it's really purely classical physics and do not really relate so much to electronic correlations. All these charge surfaces and redistribution and so on, That's actually practically classical physics. It's very beautiful physics, but it's classical physics. And it will be really interesting to think of what kind of specific effects connected with correlations should be there. There should be definitely some effects. In particular, for instance, you know there are very very good materials, ordered perovskites, double perovskites, which are sometimes very good magnetoresistive material and so on. But if, for instance, you manage to make, not all of them form in the bulk, but if you manage to make one layers, layer by layer, then it will be a kind of a way to artificially create this ordered perovskite. And what really would be effect due to correlations, I don't really know. Something with magnitude, something maybe with charge ordering and so on. That's still very open field, and probably there will be a lot of future. Now, maybe just a minor effect, but it's funny really that when I prepare this talk, summary. Some of the things which I put in, like the, for instance, J=0 non-magnetic state of ruthenium, that's popped up here in this during conference, so then Goodenough mentioned this and how also jumped it. So, and actually, that's simply the title of our conference and title of workshop is this m to the power of 4, moments and multiplets and mode material. That actually contains moments and multiplets, this part. Very often, actually, in theoretical models, these things are ignored. But if you want to make a model realistic, we have to include also this spin-orbit coupling. It was already discussed many times here. And one of the possibilities, one of the examples, very striking examples, maybe that ruthenium could be, in principle, non-magnetic. But another example, maybe not less surprising, is consider T2G1 system, like titanium. It has spin 1/2, and orbital moment is effectively 1, but minus 1. But g-factor of spin is 2, g-factor of orbital is 1. So if you just sum them together, then your total g-factor would be 0 in ideal regular octahedra. So it's actually orbital moment is non-zero, spin is non-zero, but they exactly cancel one another, so that there would be no coupling of these atoms to magnetic field. That's, of course, very idealized situation only in ideal octahedra, but simply to illustrate what kind of funny things we can have due to spin orbit coupling. Now, another point which was raised several times during, and very important point which I expect should have some development in near future, that's actually a possible role of oxygen hole. That's actually a favorite topic of George. He actually always just advertised this one. And in particular, actually, this is famous Zanna-Zawadzki-Allen phase diagram, in which you have mod insulator, that's charge transfer energy as function of T, and charge transfer insulator. And we know more or less what to expect if I start with mod insulator and I increase effective U. I should have mod transition of some type sooner or later. But what happens if I keep large U, but decrease charge transfer energy, making charge transfer energy smaller or negative? That's actually a rather open question. There are different possibilities here. I can add up in metal, but metal with strong correlation. It would be similar to heavy Fermat metal in a sense, because one component is correlated, another, the electrons may be not correlated. Or it may be insulator, like Kondo insulator. There may be this charge distribution, what we heard from Igor Mazin. And I'm pretty sure that oxygen holes are really very important for this charge distribution and so on. So that's actually still a field which should be looked more in our field. Now, that's actually what I wanted to, Well, there are many materials in which this is relevant, and especially this material which have formally high oxidation state or high valence. Because, for instance, consider, say, perovskite material strontium iron O3. Iron is formally 4+. But of course, iron is never 4+. It's very difficult to take 4 electrons out of iron. It's rather 3+ oxygen hole. And then it charge segregate into 4+ is not unstable, segregate into 3+ and 5+. 5+ is even worse. It's probably 3+ and 2 oxygen holes. And that's actually very typical for high oxidation states, not in the beginning of 3D series. Titanium, vanadium, they're perfectly happy with 5+ vanadium, for instance. But to the right of the 3D series, that's actually always the case. Say like copper 3+, that's all we know from high TC material. When you try to make copper 3+, you put the holes on oxygen mostly. Well, in general, actually, there is general tendency that charge transfer gap maybe change more or less like this. If I go from titanium to say iron and say copper, and then for 2 plus it goes like this, for 3 plus it goes like this, for 4 plus it goes like this. So 3 plus copper is already unstable, 4 plus iron is already unstable. That's more or less the rule, and that's also measured directly by photoemission. Now, at the end, I want to maybe just discuss a few, for me at least, open problems in general physics of collected electrons. And of course, it's really, once again, that's my own kind of selection of problems. Maybe you would say some other problems are more important, or maybe you would say that some of the problems which I put as open are now really rather clear now, and so on. But for instance, one problem is the absence or presence of ferromagnetism in simple Hubbard model. There was a lot of activity, actually, when you dope Hubbard model for large U, we all know this Nagaoka theorem, but it's that it will be ferromagnetic, really, for bipartite lattice only, and I have U equal to infinity and one extra electron on one extra hole. But as soon as I go to two extra electrons, two extra holes, it's already maybe not the case. It is not thermodynamic statement, really. There are now such models and such rigorous statements that indeed there may exist or there should exist ferromagnetism if I have exactly dispersionless bands. But what about this? Yeah, right, and also in some frustrated systems, probably, because frustrated systems also very often have these flat bands. But in principle, for more conventional situation, it may be an open problem. Do we really require Hund's rule coupling to stabilize ferromagnetism in some systems like iron or cobalt, or in principle it may exist even without Hund's rule coupling? That's one problem. Another problem may be superconductivity in pure Hubbard models. So there are quite a lot of results, actually, but at least for me, I'm still kind of not convinced this either answer. I don't really know. Maybe, again, I don't know some new development, but for me, it's actually a very important and interesting question. Now, another very important question, which was also discussed already and raised here, but especially it was active in the beginning of ITC, and now it's resurfaced. The nature of single particle excitations. We know that in strongly correlated systems, there is very strong coupling between single particle and excitation and magnetic background. All these phenomena of confinement, trace of wrong spins, and so on and so forth. And in particular, that's also related to the question of large versus small Fermi surface. Especially Patrick Lee was stressed it at the beginning of ITC very strongly. Then later on, somehow, just people were satisfied that, okay, fine, photoemission shows large Fermi surface and so on. But very recent magneto oscillation data seems to kind of go the full circle and go back to small Fermi surface. Also, the question of Hall effect, whether it's determined by these only small pockets of Fermi surface or whatever. And the last point which I wanted to raise, actually, that's again was already touched upon in our workshop. Actually, what is really Mott insulator? That's actually the question which Andy Millis also just raised. Now, we all are used to think of, say, Mott insulator and Mott transition. And suppose that I want to think of Mott transition in the same way as we are usually thinking of ordinary phase transition. In Landau paradigm, Landau sense. Landau paradigm means that we have to define order parameter, and we have to say something about broken symmetry. So what is the symmetry which discriminates Mott insulator and ordinary metal? I forget now about magnetic possible magnetic ordering. If it is there, okay, fine, that's actually a standard picture. But suppose that there is no magnetic ordering. So can we say what is the symmetry which discriminates, we differentiate between Mott insulator and normal metal? And it looks like we cannot really define it using only ground state average. And that's actually what is required by Landau. Ground state average of something, of some operator. Maybe anything, it may be magnetization, it may be whatever you like. but ground state average. And the ground state average seems that they don't know whether we are dealing with ground states are going and quite smoothly. Whatever you look at the ground state average, it goes completely smoothly from metal to insulator. It's rather a property of first excited state, not so much property of ground state, but rather first excited state, or frequency dependence, when omega goes to zero. And that's probably why this DMFT, which at least has some chance to catch some frequency dependence, may be really very important also to read this. And actually, I must say that I had this question already for a long time and didn't have an answer. When HITC start appeared, when the whole theoretical community, very famous theoreticians, started to work on these problems, and I thought that, okay, fine, maybe finally there will be a solution of this problem. And especially when people started speaking about some gauge symmetries and so on, I thought, okay, maybe that's actually will be finally it. And nothing came out until now yet. Just last March meeting, there was actually a very interesting session when Michael Levine and just people discussed some new paradigm, if you like, the topological order. So it could be that it will finally give some solution of this question. Maybe not, I don't really know. Well, maybe, okay. But can you tell me what is the symmetry which is broken when I go from one to the other? Nothing. So Z factor, so Z. Effectively, you proposed just to treat Z as order parameter, yeah? For instance. Well, maybe that's a possibility, but at least it doesn't look like ordinary Landau description, that's for sure. Yeah, well, as I said, actually, that's, I like that there is some discussion and people disagree with me. That's actually very good. That's what I wanted. I wanted really just to steer the discussion. In any case, I want to conclude. That's actually my last slide, that there are some of deep questions, in my opinion, at least, are still open, and we are working in a good field. Well, that's it. Now, actually, I forgot to mention that I did not really say anything about some real theoretical development, and that's, of course, very important. Some theoretical technique, like, say, DMFT, or like this new type of Monte Carlo, or also some new experimental technique. Of course, they are crucial. So maybe George, if he still wants, and we still have some time, may say a few things about that. But other than that, I'm done.
About this charge transfer gap business and holes on the anions rather than the cations, another direction to go, of course, is to go from the oxides to the sulfides to the selenides, tellurides, because the charge transfer gap very systematically in a equivalent lattice would decrease very nicely. In fact, that was part of our argument when we made that ZSA diagram, that copper diiodide, for example, doesn't exist because it would be a negative charge transfer gap if it did, and then the iodine would be, you would have one hole per every iodine, for every two iodines, and then the iodine would simply go away and you'd have copper monoiodide, and that in fact is the only stable one. So, but there's interesting things to go along the sulfide, along the anion line too. I think many of the systems, you know, we're so used to talking about cobalt 4 plus and cobalt 3 plus and manganese 4 plus that I think the cobaltates, for example, I really suspect that actually the main charge action actually is on the oxygen and that you're forming these associated, much like Zhang-Rai singlet-like things, but of a very different symmetry and so on, but that kind of thing. Then it's much easier, I think, to, you know, your symmetries are still the same, so it becomes a little bit of a formality, actually. But it might be a lot easier to describe the very different properties that one can get in those systems. It's very different. It can be very different, and you can go eventually to a phase in which it's more like a condo lattice system, shall we say, rather than the kind of systems we're actually talking about, right? I just wanted to say, to say one thing about one experimental technique that I find rather exciting, and that is the non-resonant inelastic X-ray scattering, because that technique has energy resolutions of down to 1 mV, and there's recent experiments that show that you can nicely see the DD excitations in, for example, nickel oxide is the example. That was not for very good resolution, but at Spring 8, they have now done that same experiment with very high resolution, down to 6 mV, and that's very exciting. Just imagine a cuprate or a manganite. Just imagine a hole in an x squared minus y squared orbital. And just imagine a local spectroscopy where I flip that hole. It's just a DD excitation. Some call it an orbiton. It's a DD exciton. Just flip that hole into a DZ squared orientation. Okay, that's an excited state. We know where it is because it's been measured with resonant soft X-ray scattering. Just imagine doing that. What happens? Well, first of all, there's a very strong change in the electron lattice coupling. So you should be able to see in the spectral distribution very much information about the electron-phonon coupling, and interpretable, I think, in a much easier way than photo emission. But secondly, what happens when you flip this orbital over? You actually nullify the super exchange. You kill the super exchange, and that's very high in the cuprates. So at the same time, you would be looking at the electron-magnon coupling in your spectral distribution. I find that terribly exciting. So nothing has been done yet, but it will be.
Do some of the... Leon, do you want to say something? It's too bad. It's too bad. I know. Well, but... no one else has any perspective on what some of the outstanding issues are that wants to... Okay. Well, really, we should take some votes on these, some of these things, some of these questions.
No, that's actually essentially what I also mentioned, that this composite multiferroic, say you take, say, for instance, good ferromagnet with strong magnet restriction, you put on top of it, say, good ferroelectric with strong piezo effect, and they couple via strain, and that's actually really works. It may be artificial multilayers, or it may be something what Ramesh is doing, some nanopillars, or maybe simply completely random mixture of these things, it may really work. But as to multiferroic, if you want to say that, somehow just recently the main activity is in the second type, when magnetically driven ferroelectricity completely due to magnetism. But there is much bigger class of what I call first type of multiferroic, in which ferroelectricity is and magnetism are due to different mechanisms, maybe sometimes different groups in the system, but they're coupled. And very important question is how to optimize this coupling. What does it depend on? For instance, is it good to have strong pin-orbit coupling or it's bad? So what really determines this coupling between these two subsystems? There's still quite a lot of open questions, actually, and very important ones. But for instance, this bismuth ferrite might be the best example because it's actually, what it is, ferroelectric transition at 1,000 Kelvin and magnetic 600, so at room temperature it's perfect. But coupling is weak. So how to make coupling stronger, and what does it depend on? And what type of what different type of multiferroelectric do we have? It's still quite a lot of interesting thing, really. But I think that's still a lot of interesting things, but I simply don't think that they have such a deep fundamental puzzle, so to say. Like, for instance, in HITC, we still don't understand basic things. Well, maybe not everyone agrees, but...
What is the deep fundamental puzzle of mod transition?
In mod transition?
Yeah.
Well, symmetry. Symmetry. For me. No. Well, no order parameter. No, that's,
I mean,
but that's just the point. That there is no order parameter.
I like seeing this passion. I mean, and I'm sure we all feel it, but some of us are not so outspoken. Okay, well, let me see, but don't go anywhere yet. I wanted to say three things. One is that there will just be one shuttle going over to the West Western, and that will be leaving at 4 o'clock. I assume the usual pickup spot. Second thing I wanted to do was to thank the KITP staff for putting on, once again, just doing a fantastic job in such a way that we didn't really notice them, which is, but I want to notice them now, and particularly Jocelyn Quick. Okay, and finally, I want to talk about the organizers, and as one of the organizers, it may be a little bit delicate, but since I did absolutely nothing, it's easy. So I want to thank those of the organizers who did all the work, and particularly Nicola, I think, should be singled out, and I think it's been a very stimulating conference, a great mix of different problems and different challenges, and I personally would like to thank her and thank all of you for coming and taking part and making the conference that it was.